Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of Blotter Briefs, Teehee Briefs. This one is brought to you by Scott J., whose level of Patreon support entitles him to collaborate with me on, or assign me to, a lineup feature. For more information on how you can get me to survey various true crime properties in just this way, visit the Patreon page at patreon.com/blotterpresents. Now let's get into this ranking of five unsolved mysteries segments that I have uncleverly titled Magical Unsolved Mysteries Tour. If you want to pause your playback and watch these for yourselves, the better to agree with slash object with authority to my commentary, I will be discussing the following stories. Season 1, Episode 22, The Liz Carmichael Con. Season 1, Episode 24, Carrie Lynn Nixon with an assist from the New Kids. Season 4, Episode 1, Sally McNally, Shane Stewart, and Satan. Season 5, Episode 32, Rhonda Johnson and Sharon Shaw in the so-called Killing Fields of Texas. And Season 8, Episode 12, Ghosts of the Comedy Store. I will link to all of these episodes in the show notes, as Googling for them can result in some fruitless wandering about in the Amazon Prime archives thanks to fickle labeling. Speaking of fickle, what exactly am I ranking on here? Scott selected all Robert Stackisodes, although some of the mysteries do get updates in Dennis Farinasodes later on. I think he chose on the basis of their endurance in his memory, but the two of us still weren't sure on quite what basis to rank them. Most chilling, most abusive to the late Stack's eminent dignity. We've got a pretty clear quote winner on that last one, but I have decided to go with a pretty straight, most interesting slash compelling ranking. Like, if you're thinking to yourself, self, why haven't I, an Amazon Prime member, settled in with an Unsolved Mysteries marathon, and you just don't know where to start? These are definitely all very unsolved mysterious in how typical they are, for good or ill, but they're not all necessarily recommended. So I'm going to rank them from least to most worth rewatching, beginning with the least crimey of the lot, which is also the least interesting to me and the least respectful of poor Bob Stack, he slash Cy. Season 8, Episode 12, Ghosts of the Comedy Store. The only real crime element here, leaving aside the metaphorical misdemeanor of comedians using UM reenactments to try to raise their profiles, is the theory advanced by some of the segment participants that the ghosts who manifested visibly over the years were consistently in 1940s garb, therefore probably dating from the era when the Comedy Store building was the nightclub Ciro's something-something mobsters fish cakes. I don't know. I do know that I was watching closely to see if and when any real comedians deigned to appear on the episode, versus the file footage of luminaries like Arsenio and Richard Pryor that opened the segment. It's nobody you think you've heard of, but in this next clip, Joey Gaynor and Blake Clark, the latter may be known to some of you from either Boy Meets World or from playing the hardware store guy on Home Improvement, recreate their foolish taunting of the resident Haint.
When I do this, hey, come on out. Come on, ghost. Show yourself. Come on, where are you?
I saw this ashtray just go across the room and burst onto the wall. And so Joey says, what was that? What did you throw that at me? And I went, no, it came from over there.
It was like zoom, you know. To see it come up and take off is what was scary. I was always skeptical because we're talking about comedians telling stories. However, I did see it.
Then VP of Operations Michael Becker probably has the right take on the situation, and while I am more prone than some to believe in hauntings and didn't not enjoy a ghost winging a full ashtray at Gaynor's head, this is late season Unsolved Mysteries cheese in terms of believability and barrel scraping. Stack, narrating from the stage at the Comedy Store, is obliged to do a dumb bit at the end involving a ghost moving a stool, and he's a pro about it. But if Scott hadn't asked me to watch this, I'd have auto-skipped it, the way I do most post-season 4 ghost segments and anything involving aliens. It isn't a terrible segment, but of these, it is ranked last for me. Next up, Season 5, Episode 24, The Texas Killing Fields Claimed More Victims Than You Think. Rhonda Johnson and Sharon Shaw disappeared in early August of 1971. Their skeletal remains were discovered early the next year, and while a man named Michael Self was convicted of their murders, conventional wisdom now seems to hold that either serial killer Edward Harold Bell did it, or some other serial killer active at the same time and also using the so-called Texas killing fields as a dumping ground did it. Bell confessed to it, but as Bill James has noted, you can't take a serial killer at his word. They lie about everything. And as this UM segment notes, at length, Michael Self also confessed to it more than once. This, according to Self, coerced admission was the only evidence against Self. But he was still sent to prison for the crimes, while the allegedly crooked cops who beat the confessions out of him suffered no consequences.
I did not kill Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson. It was just all behind politics and wanting a conviction. That was it. Just somebody to play the patsy.
Imagine that you're a jury member in a murder trial. The defendant has confessed twice, and you vote to convict him. Later, you discover the confessions were allegedly coerced by two police officers who used a kind of rough justice, physical and psychological intimidation. As it turned out, those two police officers were criminals themselves. It may seem incredible, but Michael Self claims that he was a victim of just that scenario.
Actually, Staxi, what seems incredible is how incredible it doesn't seem here in 2018, when it feels like every second or third true crime tale involves a variation on "I'd have said any damn thing if they would have agreed to let me go home." Alas, the segment is a bit draggy because its outline is all too familiar to the experienced crime consumer. One of my benchmarks of how compelling a property is how willing I am to postpone Googling the outcome. This one didn't pass muster in that regard, and once I discovered that, all his appeals having long since been denied, Self died in prison of cancer at the relatively tender age of 53, it got that much harder to give it my full attention. I will give the segment this. It does send one down all sorts of other wiki holes, including one that leads to a movie about the Texas killing fields starring my bass boyfriend Jeffrey Dean Morgan. And I admit that it may say more about me as a viewer and the fact that this kind of criminal injustice story feels comparatively routine to me at this point than it does about the segment itself. But while it's very typical of unsolved mysteries, I'm bound to note that unsolved mysteries can be somewhat superfluous and boring. Did I pass the time writing a bunch of wretchedly tasteless headlines in my notes based on the last name Self and puns thereto? I sure did. Did that speak to whether this segment is worth your time? I am not sure it does. And no, I will not share these headlines with you. Fine, I will share one. Not my bodies, myself. I tried to tell y'all. In the event that anyone is still listening, let's move on to Season 1, Episode 24, Carrie Lynn Nixon Disappears, into a New Kids on the Block video? There isn't much more to the story than that, I'm afraid. In 1987, 16-year-old Carrie Lynn Nixon disappeared steps from her house in a 5-minute window of time. A massive search failed to find her. An anonymous letter claiming to have seen her in South Carolina was a dead-end lead. After a few years, her parents somehow got their hands on a New Kids concert video and thought they might have spotted Carrie in the crowd, and while it doesn't look all that much like her when you spend more than a second with it, the girl in the video looks much more to me like the second actor to play Mark Green's daughter Rachel on ER, you can see how the idea that it might be Carrie gained steam. Teen Steam. Wait, wrong turn of the 80s product. The segment overall, in its original iteration, plays kinda long, or it seems to, since, spoiler, you know it's not the same girl. And even if you don't know that, you know that. You know the likely outcome in a case like this, and you're not wrong. Carrie's remains were discovered not far from her home in 1994. Robert Anthony Jones confessed to murdering her, and remains incarcerated as of this recording. But when the Unsolved Mysteries was recorded, they didn't know any of that yet, and New Kids Jonathan and Jordan Knight pitched in to help identify the girl in the video and urge Carrie to call home. Well, as much as they could help, when sounding somewhat like they were in a hostage video of their own.
Members of the New Kids on the Block did not recognize the girl in the crowd, but after hearing Carrie's story, wanted to make a personal appeal.
Well, I'd just like to say to Carrie that if you're out there, the best thing to do would just be to call somebody and, you know, even if you go to your local police and just tell them your situation, then maybe they can help you out.
Or if any of you viewers out there who have seen her at a New Kids show or just seen her on the street, if you could contact someone, you know, to let them know where she is, or if she's all right or anything, that would be a big help.
The primary attraction of this story is the downright weird involvement of the New Kids, whose reliably cringy and dated presentation is not necessarily entertaining enough to offset the evident and still fresh pain of Carrie Lynn Nixon's friends and family as they continue in the face of mounting odds to search for their loved one. Mildly diverting, but landed right in the middle of my ranking at number 3. At number 2, we have Season 1, Episode 22, Liz Carmichael Cons the Boys. Liz Carmichael had a solution to the early 70s gas shortage that had millions waiting in line at service stations around the country. The Dale, a three-wheeled jobby that would get 70 miles per gallon and still cost less than $2,000. Unfortunately, this idea was about all Liz Carmichael had. Although she impressed funders and industry bigwigs by talking the talk, and in several regrettable talking head interviews with her, quote, manly formidability in a corporate situation, it eventually became apparent that Carmichael had no manufacturing facility, no prototype that even contained bagatelles like an engine, no cars to furnish the franchisees with whom she'd already contracted. Carmichael also did not have factory-installed lady parts, so to say.
She was working for a dating service and going by the name of Susan Raines. They also learned that Liz Carmichael had another identity. She was really a man, Jerry Dean Michael. Michael claimed he had begun hormone treatments in preparation for a sex change operation. It was later learned that Michael was wanted by the federal authorities for counterfeiting in 1961 and jumping bail in 1962.
We had no doubt that this was a woman. You just didn't question it. You just didn't question it.
I never thought that Liz was a man. I always thought that, and she is today, she's still Liz to me, still a female.
This episode is old, so it's not talking about trans people and trans issues in the way that we talk about it now. But the clip we just heard only increased my curiosity, not about that part of it, but about Carmichael's cons and forgery charges before she started living as Liz. I wish we'd gotten a longer look at the cons themselves. Scott J. noted when he sent me his list of episodes that it was not entirely clear, at least through the lens of this segment, whether Carmichael was genuinely trans or living as a woman was just part of a con. That she was apprehended not long after the segment originally aired, still living as a woman, albeit with another name. When a con artist who was merely leveraging gender to escape the notice of authorities would, in my opinion, have returned to living as a man. Because in my experience, nobody necessarily clocks a 6-foot guy, but a 6-foot gal is going to disrupt the pattern rack a little bit more. All that suggests to me that this part of Michael's / Carmichael's reinvention was genuine. The episode is not really having it. Predictably, Carmichael is played by a male-identifying person. I suppose I shouldn't. In the reenactments. And is referred to as him in narration once her origins are revealed. Authorities were not having it either, detailing the Katherine Johnson they found after airtime living in, of all places, Dale, Texas, to an all-male facility, though she maintained her Carmichael identity at trial. This is a really interesting segment because of the way the actual cons are braided together with Carmichael's gender identity. I guess it's easy to dismiss that part of it with "Con's gonna con," so that you don't have to unpack the section of the suitcase that makes Liz Carmichael a vanguard of sorts. Girlfriend was running what amounts, with a few tweaks, to a big store con in a male-dominated industry, and she could have changed back to Jerry Dean when she went on the lam, in theory. Except in practice, she couldn't, because even though it would have helped her elude authorities, it's not who she was. Please let this story become American Crime Story Season 6. So very here for it. Even without Ryan Murphy's help, this segment is my number 2, and it was a tough call. But as compelling as this one was, here's my top segment of the ones Scott J. selected for me. Season 4, Episode 1. Another 80s crime blamed on non-existent Satanists. High school sweethearts Sally McNally and Shane Stewart vanished on 4th of July, 1988. Their skeletized remains were found later, and what little evidence that left to authorities suggested they'd both been killed by shotgun. We're no closer today to knowing why or by whom than we were 30 years ago. I'll link to this article in the show notes, but there's an update from earlier this year on the local website, GoSanAngelo.com, about a raid on the home of a person of interest that, while still not terribly satisfying in terms of closing the case, is a damn sight more useful than the unsolved mysteries angle on it, to wit, when Sally and Shane decided to leave the satanic cult they'd been dabbling in because the cult started doing real crimes, the other cultists killed them. I shouldn't make too much light of this theory, actually. Yes, it's asinine, but the ascribing of terrible murders to Satanists was so prevalent in the 80s and early 90s, and wreaked so much havoc on the lives of innocent people rammed through the, quote, justice system based on wearing black and listening to heavy metal, that the stupidity of it is exceeded only by the extent of the damage it caused. I'm referring, of course, to the West Memphis Three, but not only to them. The San Antonio Four, McMartin Preschool, we could all go on. The West Memphis Three are far from the only victims of this kind of black magical thinking. And in a way, I do understand how a community comes to believe collectively that a crime must have been the work of hell's minions on earth. Maybe it's just too hard to wrap one's mind around certain crimes otherwise. I believe it's John Douglas who has a line in The Cases That Haunt Us about how the legends of vampires and werewolves came to be. That sometimes a village or settlement witnessed a murder so physically brutal that their minds couldn't get around the idea that it wasn't a demon or an animal or a demonic animal. So that way of thinking is actually comprehensible, if easy to ridicule for its utter lack of sophistication. Douglas was, after all, referring to villages of the 12th century. But at the same time, these theories have to be taken seriously because of law enforcement's historical ability to prosecute with them, whether in ignorance or in cynical confidence that a Megadeth t-shirt will let the presiding DA put a case down. In the next clip, you'll hear from Sally's mother about what she was told Sally was getting up to in her free time, and from a friend of Sally's about what motivated Sally to immerse herself in this manifestly goofy activity. Helen's comments in particular are striking to me. The portrait of Sally that emerges in the segment generally is of a fairly typical teenage quest for acceptance, for the feeling of being a part of something, that the episode almost inadvertently underlines as a try-hard teen's reason for perhaps performatively doing a cult.
I called one friend of Sally's. The boy's mother answered the phone, and she told me that the kids were mixed up in Satan worship. And she said that a group of kids had been at her house one night and said they had a demon in a bottle.
Sally really got to a point to where she thought, nobody loves me. These people come along and they say, okay, we'll give you that love. We'll give you that companionship that you need. You just come with us and do what we ask.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I know what I mean. But anyway, I'm glad I'm here.
Sally began to attend ritualistic parties on a regular basis. One evening, she invited Helen to join her.
It's Ouija time.
Turn out the lights.
I'm going to need everyone listening to start saying it's Ouija time, turn out the lights for no reason, as I have now been doing for a couple of weeks. Despite the figures of fun that both small-town Satanist strivers and the people who consider them an actual danger can cut, there is a heaviness to this segment. You're about to hear from Shane's dad, Marshall, who, not for nothing, could be a small-town Texas composite of Jason Ritter and Christopher Knight. Proof of that, along with some other visual aids, will be on the blog at the-blotter.com. You'll find this piece at the top of the carousel. He's talking about the discovery of the bodies. Marshall plays himself in the reenactment, which I thought the show had stopped doing after the middle of the first season, and which is an interesting choice, to say the least, under the circumstances, and quite an affecting one.
Gut feeling is apparent. I knew they had found Shane.
Hi, Marshall.
Hello, Liz. How are you?
Marshall, how you doing?
Y'all find Shane's body?
Yeah, we sure did, and it's pretty gruesome in there.
I want to see him.
Well, we just want to let you know that there's not a whole lot left.
I want to see him.
Okay, let's go with you.
It was Shane, dressed exactly like he'd left the house that night. And I knelt down beside him and told him that I had found him and we would take him home.
It's a little bit difficult to hear, but law enforcement is telling Marshall that they found Shane and that it's a gruesome scene. And this is Marshall himself reenacting this moment for the show. His face as he's telling the camera about telling Shane that he was there to take him home. You don't expect this sort of unembellished sadness from this program. You also don't expect a crime of this sort to be solved at this late date. Maybe this Galbraith fella did it. Maybe it had to do with Shane failing to pay a debt. Maybe it was those little Satanist shitheads. Who knows? But this segment, to me, is really about Marshall Stewart testifying for his son to bring him justice and himself peace. And it is not all that typical of the show, but it's still quite something. And of these segments, I think it is the noteworthiest. And that is a wrap on this lineup of five notable unsolved mysteries selected by Scott J. In the words of Ray and Graff, didn't we have a time? Just kidding. I actually did enjoy getting to know these stories and seeing how the show evolved or devolved over the seasons. To watch for yourself, again, you can head to the show notes for the links, and to make me put together a similar lineup for you, get on the tipster line at patreon.com/blotterpresents. There is, as of this recording, still time to make a gift of monthly support in the name of a friend or loved one. Or hated rival, I don't know your lives. I do know that I like to hear from you guys about past, present, and possible future Blotter topics, regardless of whether you're Patreon supporters, and you can all reach out to me on social at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening to this Blotter Brief. I've been your host, Sarah D. Bunting. There is someone, somewhere, who would like to tune in on Boxing Day for the Blotter Presents Best of 2018 episode.
Perhaps it's you.